The failure of drug war is glaringly obvious to judges, cops, wardens, prosecutors, and millions more now calling for decriminalization, legalization, the end of prohibition. Let us investigate the Century of Lies.
Hello, and welcome to Century of Lies. I'm your host, Doug McVeigh. The New Zealand Drug Foundation recently launched a major new report entitled Safer Drug Laws for Aotearoa, New Zealand, Evidence to Inform Regulatory Change. The report's release coincides with the 50th anniversary of New Zealand's Misuse of Drugs Act becoming law in 1975. We'll hear some audio from that launch later on today's show. But first, the Security Council of the United Nations held an emergency meeting Friday, October 10th, at the request of Venezuela to address recent deadly military strikes by the United States on vessels in the Caribbean that were alleged to be involved in drugs. Here's His Excellency Samuel Moncada, permanent representative of the Bolivarian Republic of Venezuela to the United Nations, addressing the Security Council.
Señor Presidente.
Mr. President, we come to this Security Council to lodge a complaint, one of the most serious complaints possible. We are here to alert this Council to a series of actions that threaten not only peace and security in our nation, but also of the entire Latin American and Caribbean region. Mr. President, for years, the government of the United States has been conducting a propaganda and disinformation campaign against our country. At present, it is undertaking an escalating deployment of military forces mere miles from Venezuelan coasts. The military escalation involves the offensive mobilization of more than 10,000 troops, combat aircraft, missile destroyers and cruisers, assault troops, assets used in special operations and in covert missions, and even a nuclear submarine. The belligerent action and rhetoric of the US government objectively point to the fact that we are facing a situation in which it is rational to anticipate that in the very short term, an armed attack is to be perpetrated against Venezuela. That's why we're here, because this Security Council has the necessary means to prevent further worsening of the situation. We are here to avert the commission of an international crime. The Charter of the United Nations provides all of us here in this chamber with the means needed not only to confirm the existence of a threat, but also to be able to preserve regional and international peace and security. Should this body possess the political will to fulfill its mandate, it can use these means. The world is watching you today. Let's not betray those of us who placed our trust in the Security Council, because those of us who signed up to the UN Charter. President, the United States narrative has feet of clay. It bears no relation to reality. And indeed, since January this year, this government has sought to convince the world that Venezuelans right now, today, are carrying out an invasion on the territory of this country, that the presence of Venezuelans, due to their nationality alone, is contrary to US security, and that they are all terrorists. This is the criminalization of the entire Venezuelan people. Through this disinformation campaign, the United States government is attacking Venezuelans within and outside US territory. It considers them a threat, foreign enemies, and just a few days ago, it declared that it was in the midst of an alleged non-international armed conflict with the sole aim of having carte blanche to wage war against Venezuela. All of this has been reaffirmed with impunity by the US government without a shred of evidence. Peace in the region is in grave danger on the basis of a fiction promoted by a warmongering government eager to attack an entire nation and its people. Mr. President, Today, we are all seeing the first tragic consequences of this reality that our region is facing. The United States government has recognized that thousands of kilometers from its own coasts, it has bombed four small vessels in the Caribbean, killing 21 unarmed civilians, which never posed any threat to national security. The United States government conceals its crimes under the guise of self-defense. In so doing, it murders civilians without providing information as to their identity, without proving the nature of the cargo aboard the vessels, and without providing any evidence on the imminent nature of an armed attack against US forces. This is not self-defense. These are extrajudicial killings. There is a killer roaming in the Caribbean, one that is seeking excuses to manufacture a conflict, to attack, to manipulate the principle of self-defense, and he wants to kill more. There are procedures established around the world to combat drugs without killing the suspects. The United States is the only government that proclaims the principle shoot first and check later. Who could believe that this large-scale military escalation in the Caribbean is truly aimed at combating drugs trafficking? The truth is that the United States government, as has been confirmed by international media, has already issued a secret order to authorize the use of military force in foreign territory with the pretext of a false war against drugs trafficking. At the same time, the CIA has also been authorized to conduct clandestine operations across Latin America and the Caribbean, all points to a new hour of aggression in our region. President, the conflict doesn't exist. It is being manufactured by the United States, and the reason is as follows. While it is true that this country is facing a tragedy created by drug addiction, which is very regrettable, and one on which we stand ready to cooperate to address this grave public health situation, there is another dangerous addiction that remains unspoken here. This is the addiction to oil. The United States is desperate to control all of the sources of oil around the world, and it believes that Venezuelan oil belongs to it. Its desperate addiction, therefore, leads it to violate all norms of international law. We've seen this in Iraq, in Syria, in Libya, and in Afghanistan. But now is the time to prevent a new war, a war on Venezuela. If Venezuela did not have oil, the imminent military threat would not exist. The plan is clear. It's an attempt once again to undertake an operation that's already failed, which is to overthrow the legitimate and constitutional president of the Bolivarian Republic of Venezuela, Nicolas Maduro Moros, in order to install a puppet regime and turn our country into a colony. Without presenting any evidence, the government of the United States is appointing itself both judge and executioner against an entire people. International law, however, also applies to the United States. It isn't an exceptional country. It is sitting around this table because it committed to upholding the United Nations Charter. Venezuela comes here today to demand that the government of the United States uphold its international obligations. The necessary means to resolve this situation do exist. Our country has always been and will always stand ready to engage in dialogue to overcome politically and diplomatically any difficulty to protect our region as a zone of peace. Something that we do need to discuss bilaterally and urgently relates to the repatriation of 78 Venezuelans abducted in the United States who have been separated from their families by a cruel and racist policy. Children cannot be used as hostages to extort Venezuela. President, what right does the United States have to militarize the Caribbean region? None. What right does the United States have to execute civilians that are entitled to the presumption of innocence and to due process? None. What right does the United States have to terrorize and deprive humble fishers from their livelihoods around the Caribbean region? None. The United States believes that the Caribbean belongs to it because for more than 100 years it has been applying the voracious Monroe Doctrine, which is no more than a relic of colonialism. Our region has had first-hand experience of US invasions. Throughout its 250-year history, the United States has only had 4 years of peace, and today it stands ready to set the Caribbean ablaze to uphold its ideology of endless war that its own people is rejecting. The United States promotes endless war with a machine of propaganda and a true industry of death and lies. Many people have been the victims of this at some time or other, of its greed at some time or other. How many deaths will have to happen? How many years will have to pass before the entire world understands, as it has done historically, that today the United States is lying once again? Venezuela, for its part, has a profound tradition of peace. Since its independence more than two centuries ago, it has never, never been involved in an international conflict, and it is proud of this history. We do not need, nor do we seek, war against anyone. President, in light of all of this, we believe that the time has come for this Security Council to fulfill the mandate entrusted to it by the United Nations Charter and to avert a catastrophe that could destabilize the region for generations. Therefore, we propose the following three specific measures to this Council. Firstly, that the Council determine the existence of a threat to international peace and security due to the current military escalation by the United States in the Caribbean. Second, that the Council adopt the necessary measures to avoid the situation on the ground worsening further. And third, that the Council adopt a resolution in which all of its members, including the United States, commit to respecting the sovereignty, independence, and territorial integrity of the Bolivarian Republic of Venezuela. We are just asking for compliance with the Charter of the United Nations that we all committed to in this Security Council. Taking these measures would be a guarantee to immediately defuse the threat in our region. We all need peace, including the United States. President, before concluding, allow me to address a few words to our people who at this time are living in perfect peace, united and mobilized in the face of the dangers confronting our homeland. At this critical juncture for our history, all Venezuelans remember our grandparents, our great-grandparents, and all of those who fought to maintain a country in peace, with prosperity, and above all, with dignity. Venezuelans are proud of being Venezuelans. We don't seek tutelage from any empire. With great sacrifice, we have forged a country which is not subordinated to anyone. We aspire to have friendly, cooperative relations with the entire world based on mutual respect. But we will not accept insults or threats from anyone. Venezuelans do not yield to blackmail. Those who confuse our readiness for dialogue with weakness are mistaken. In our more than 200 years of history, if anyone believes that they can crush us because we are a small country, they should look back to the past and see that Venezuela was the grave of an empire. The Charter of the United Nations and the doctrine of universal peace protects Venezuela and all countries around the world. As guaranteed by Article 51 of the Charter, if Venezuela is attacked, it will then exercise its legitimate right to self-defense. We respect the United States. We respect its people who desire peace. But we warn the world that if the United States were to attack Venezuela and its people, if the United States were to profane our territory, we have the sacred duty to defend what is ours, what we have inherited from our ancestors, and that we safeguard for our children and our grandchildren. Venezuela is ours. It is not the United States. We are sure that the world will understand that in the face of an attack, we will exercise with all of the strength and the love of our homeland our right to self-defense, and even if this struggle takes generations, we will prevail. Venezuela will continue to win peace, exercising its full sovereignty and guaranteeing the right to life. Thank you very much, President.
That was His Excellency Samuel Moncada, permanent representative of the Bolivarian Republic of Venezuela to the United Nations, addressing the UN Security Council on Friday, October 10th, at an emergency meeting held at the request of Venezuela to address recent deadly military strikes by the United States on vessels in the Caribbean that were alleged to be involved in drugs. This is a developing story. We'll bring you more news when it happens, so keep tuning in. This is Century of Lies. I'm your host, Doug McVeigh. Now to our top story. On Wednesday, October 8th, the New Zealand Drug Foundation launched a major new report entitled Safer Drug Laws for Aotearoa, New Zealand, Evidence to Inform Regulatory Change. Here's Sarah Helm, Executive Director of the New Zealand Drug Foundation.
So the report sets out what the Misuse of Drugs Act has achieved, the experiences of people who have had harm happen to them, the evidence from many jurisdictions that have reformed their drug laws, and key reflections from Māori drug harm experts. Those bells, you're not imagining it. We then put forward a suite of very well evidenced, we think very pragmatic recommendations that we hope can enable the development of a more responsive law. These reforms that we suggest are not about liberalisation. In fact, they offer the opposite: safety, control, and regulation. We're realistic. We don't expect that these recommendations are going to be picked up and run with on day one, but we hope that they'll start at the start of a conversation. That's why I'm very pleased to be hosted today by the cross-party group. Today it's my job to outline the report's main findings and recommendations, so I'll get on to it. Firstly, there are seven principles that we've recommended. The law should have at its core the health and well-being of our people. Principles like reducing the impacts of drug harm, reducing fatalities, reducing substance use disorder. With those principles to guide us, we set out five pragmatic evidence-based recommendations. Firstly, the evidence was clear that decriminalisation, which is the removal of the legal penalties for use or possession, works. Therefore, we propose this as a foundation for change. It might be hard to believe, but if we go back in time to the 70s, the Blake Palmer Committee, whose work informed the Misuse of Drugs Act, actually were very trepidatious about recommending the criminalisation of drug use. And that's because they were worried that it would get in the way of people seeking help. Well, that has come to pass. Criminalisation causes wide-ranging harms, from preventing people seeking help to lifelong impacts of a criminal conviction. Now, the international evidence is actually compelling for decriminalisation. Portugal has two decades of experience now, providing the strongest case. Following decriminalisation, overdose deaths there fell dramatically, HIV rates plummeted, and of course the burden on the criminal justice system was dramatically reduced, all without an increase in drug use. In 2019, Portugal had among the lowest of the drug death rates in the EU. Now, to date, 34 countries, 36 sub-jurisdictions have decriminalised cannabis use, and 22 countries have decriminalised all drug use. So we now have a spread of countries to draw experience from, as well as Portugal's more long-term evidence. But decriminalisation alone is not a panacea. It can mitigate some of the more harmful effects of our current laws and create conditions for health interventions to work. And certainly the report shows that it offers a positive impacts on problematic use in particular. However, one of the biggest factors in Portugal's success was that decriminalisation was coupled with a substantial investment into health support and harm reduction, which is our second recommendation, to redirect resources to health interventions like treatment, harm reduction and support. The communities we engaged with were clear. They do not want to see money being poured into policing low-level crimes while health services remain underfunded. Addiction treatment and community services were repeatedly described as being stretched, inaccessible, sometimes culturally inappropriate. Internationally, where decriminalisation has come to pass and they've failed to invest in these services, the positive impacts have been muted. So based on these findings, we recommend that any law reform effort be accompanied by a deliberate, substantial investment into support, treatment, harm reduction. Our third recommendation is to enable licensing of harm reduction and overdose prevention measures within a responsive public health infrastructure. The constant frustration for those of us who work in harm reduction on the front line is that the Misuse of Drugs Act actually prevents us from doing a number of life-saving measures that would save lives and reduce social and health costs upstream. Amid the sea of harms that we've endured over the last 50 years, the few life rafts that have come have been in the form where New Zealand has taken and prioritised health and harm reduction. So most notable was the establishment, of course, of the Needle Exchange Programme in 1988, a move that to this day is responsible for us having one of the lowest HIV rates in the world. More recently, drug checking is offering us, a highly effective tool at protecting the community from the chaos of the illicit market. These interventions took years of grinding advocacy and their own extensive legislative process to become a reality. The future that we're all looking at does not have time for that. Instead, we propose a flexible, rapidly responsive regulatory framework overseen by an appropriate health agency that could license harm reduction interventions in response to emerging risks and threats. This agency, whether new or existing, could be empowered to undertake research and make decisions at arm's length with clear, specific goals to improve health outcomes. We also recommend that some interventions be legalised as soon as possible, such as overdose prevention centres, safer utensils and more flexible drug checking regime. Importantly, in this section, we also acknowledge that the law as it stands has stood in the way of the therapeutic benefits of some of the substances scheduled within it, and so we recommend the law, any new law that enables the facilitation of psychedelic therapies, of course with patient safety concerns at its core. Our fourth recommendation comes after some very, very careful consideration and concern for what other regulatory measures could be deployed to help, deal with the burgeoning supply issues we face and what in particular might be necessary in the future. The evidence suggests that commercial models of regulated access can exacerbate harm. And while there's ample international evidence for cannabis regulation models, the evidence is pretty scarce for other substances at this point. That will change over time. Moreover, the thing that's changing incredibly rapidly is our drug supply, and the illicit market is moving very quickly. It's hard to predict what even might be required in our very near future. And so our fourth recommendation is that we empower a health entity with the ability to very carefully develop regulatory supply for some low-harm substances when and if the evidence becomes available, as we anticipate it might, particularly for psychedelics and MDMA, which are covered quite extensively in the report. Moreover, to enable us to adapt if our drug problems call for new approaches. In 2023, I visited Canada, whose overdose fatality rates are some of the highest in the world. On my trip, I met with one of the heads of the British Columbian Police Force, and I asked them if they could go back in time, which in a sense New Zealand is, what would they do? Bless. And they said, in the face of the onslaught of fentanyl fatalities, they wished that they had had a safe supply of heroin to help people from ever having moved onto fentanyl in the first place, something they would never have dreamed of supporting at the time. Now, we haven't recommended that, but it bears emphasising that our future problems could make our current problems pale in comparison. And so a mechanism that enables some future adaptability is important, with careful restrictions to prevent commercial approaches, advertising supply to minors. We also recommend enabling people to grow a small number of cannabis plants, like is allowed in ACT Australia very successfully, and to consider the creation of regulated non-profit associations which have been successfully tried in countries like Malta, Uruguay, more recently Germany, which allows registered clubs to enable adults to share some cannabis between them. Lastly, we listened very carefully to Māori leaders in our sector who told us about the damage the Misuse of Drugs Act has done to Māori. They also told us of their concerns that both any new approaches could leave Māori behind or, worse, exacerbate problems for Māori. This has been the case in other jurisdictions for Indigenous people. So there's more work to be done throughout any process that we would be lucky enough to have to make sure this doesn't come to pass. But for Māori, we're recommending that given them, we've been the most negatively group impacted by the law and drug harm, that there is a ring-fence portion of funding to empower whānau, hapū and iwi to design and deliver their own solutions, and that tino rangatiratanga over our taonga fungi species be recognised. For those of us who have teenage children in the room, the future looks pretty terrifying. Communities that are drowning under the pressure of increased drug consumption deserve better answers than ones that have been dragged out repeatedly for the last 50 years of failure. I have no doubt that if action isn't taken in these great halls, we will be back here in shock at what has happened in the decade that awaits us. But today we offer careful, evidence-based proposals for you to consider and genuinely in an effort to make New Zealand's drug laws safer.
That was Sarah Helm, Executive Director of the New Zealand Drug Foundation, speaking at the launch of a major new report entitled Safer Drug Laws for Aotearoa, New Zealand, Evidence to Inform Regulatory Change. And for now, that's it. Thank you for joining us. This has been Century of Lies. I've been your host, Doug McVeigh. Century of Lies is a volunteer production for community radio, syndicated via the Pacifica Foundation Radio Network's AudioPort service. Please support public media and local community radio. Become members. Become volunteers. We'll be back in a week with 30 more minutes of news and information about drug policy and the failed war on drugs. For now, this is Doug McVeigh saying so long. So long! For the Drug Truth Network, this is Doug McVeigh asking you to examine our policy of drug prohibition, the century of lies. Drug Truth Network programs archived at the James A. Baker III Institute for Public Policy.